undulate under the shimmering desert vapors, steeds champing at the bit and high-stepping in place, appearing eager to carry their charges in an attack on the hopelessly outnumbered defenders. Yet Sebastian felt little fear. He couldn't deny a certain trepidation, scanning the tanks and armored personnel carriers, the foot soldiers, the fighters and bombers and choppers that backed up the cavalry as far as the eye could see. It was no exaggeration to call his enemy a sea of humanity, and he could not imagine a throng so massive ever having gathered in one place before. More than once he had seen most of the million-plus gathered at Petra, and impressive as that was, it was nothing compared to this. Sebastian's occasional volleys of twos and fifties had proved a nuisance for the Unity forces. He had even caused several dozen casualties, which sent Gustav Zuckermandel's crazy underlings scampering into the field to harvest weapons, IDs, and full uniforms. And the supernatural protection of Petra seemed to hold, even out here. Sebastian had lost nary a troop. Yet he knew well that if that great army merely advanced upon his position without firing a shot, his entire cache of ammunition would make not one serious dent in the overall force aligned against him. The enemy had begun advancing at a snail's pace, and while they were neither firing nor launching artillery of any sort, the mere size of that force directing its momentum his way caused the earth to tremble and the footing to become unsure. And of course he was worried about Rayford. He had seen the man protected like the rest of them, heat-seeking missiles appearing to fly directly through aircraft without harming a hair on anyone's head. What could have caused injury to him now, and why? Some had speculated that the pieces of his vehicle found in the hills might have evidenced damage from an incendiary. But the latest report from Abdullah Smith was that the damage appeared to be the result of a loss of control, that the ATV had rolled and tumbled, smashing to bits. What then about the blood trail that could have been only Rayford's? It was way beyond Sebastian to question God, but he had to wonder. Could a missile God caused to miss Rayford have still caused an accident that mortally wounded him? And who was to blame for that? Ray himself? The enemy? The bigger question now, of course, was what would come of this advance by the invaders? Sebastian believed with his whole heart that Petra was impregnable. What was he doing out here with his band of resistors, then? Presumably giving latecomers a chance to benefit from the safety of the place. Before they came within the saving influence of the Stone City, Sebastian would try everything in his power to pave the way for them, yet none had come, and he saw none on the way. Surely in a matter of hours, some said minutes, this would all be meaningless. Christ would appear, he would win the battle, and Rayford and Buck and even Zion, dead, alive, or somewhere in between, would be reunited. Still, Sebastian couldn't get Rayford off his mind. He had been trained to never leave a comrade on the battlefield, regardless. It made no sense that Smitty could find the blood trail of a man severely wounded and thus moving slowly and yet not be able to find the man himself. The best Sebastian could determine, there were no enemy personnel behind Rayford. He could not have been captured. Worst case, but most likely scenario. Ray had dug himself a shelter against the sun and died there. Did it make a difference, given that he would be with Christ, just like the rest of them, when it was all over? Of course it did. Because you don't leave a man. How long had it been since he had checked in with Smitty? He looked at his watch. Too recently. And Abdullah said he would let him know at first opportunity. But Sebastian had to do something short of heading to the hills himself, clearly an impossibility. He called Chang.
No, I haven't heard a thing yet, the young man reported. I sure wish you could be here, though. Thousands are turning to Christ right here in Petra.
That was wonderful, but Sebastian couldn't bring himself to say so. Frankly, he carried a bit of resentment, even disgust, for those who waited this long. Where had they been when all the judgments had come down? All the miracles? No sane person could deny that for the past 7 years, God and Satan had waged war. Had these people really been undecided about which side they wanted to join? Any doubt about the reality of God and both his mercy and his judgment had long since been erased.
I've got a call coming in,
Chang said. So do I, Sebastian said. Later. Big Dog One, this is Camel Jockey.
Go ahead, Smitty, Sebastian said.
And Techie, are you there?
Roger,
Chang said. I've spotted Captain Steele.
Enoch Dumas awoke just after 7:30 in the morning. His musty mattress in the basement of an abandoned house in Palos Hills, Illinois, was warm where he had slept and cold where he hadn't, and he hadn't slept much. All night he had told himself that today was the day. He couldn't imagine sleeping past 4 a.m., but the truth was that was about the time he finally dozed. 8 in the morning Central Time would mark 7 years to the minute since the signing of the covenant between Antichrist and Israel, a covenant that had been broken years earlier, but which marked the years before the glorious appearing of Christ. The place, his little church of 30 or so down-and-outers from the inner city of Chicago, had incongruously burgeoned since they had been scattered to the suburbs with the compromising of the Tribulation Force safe house. They no longer had a central meeting place. While people who know these things warned they should trust no newcomers, every time they got together, more were added to their number. And because they recognized the seal of the believer on the foreheads of the newcomers, Enoch knew they had not been infiltrated. They now numbered nearly 100. While some had been martyred, a surprising majority had eluded detection and capture, though they busied themselves every day trying to gather more converts. Getting more drowning people onto the life raft, Enoch called it. Sometimes he even found himself urging caution to passionate new believers and warning them that the enemy was constantly on the lookout, eager to devour them, to make them statistics. And yet he was often reminded, usually by one of his own flock, that there was no other choice now than to be overt in their witness. His favorite times were when the floor was opened and people who risked their very lives by assembling in secret would exude the joy of heaven when they spoke. He could not, nor did he want to, erase from his mind's eye the testimony of Carmela, a 50-ish heavyset Latina. In an abandoned laser tag park about 10 miles west of Enoch's quarters, she had stood telling her story with tears running down her generous cheeks.
"I once was blind, but now I see is the only way I can say it," she said. "I was blind to God, blind to Jesus, selling my body to buy drugs and food. I had left everything and everybody important to me. Before I knew it, I only cared about me and my next high. It was all about survival. Kill or be killed. Do what you gotta do. But then one day one of you came to me, and it was her, right there."
Carmela had pointed to an older woman, an African-American named Shaniqua. "She handed me one of the brochures about the meetings and all, and she said, 'Somebody loves you.' I thought, 'Somebody loves me? Tell me something I don't know. Men trying to love me all day, but I knew better. Nobody loved me. Fact, they hated me, used me. I meant nothing more to them than their next meal or their next high. Just what they meant to me. Nobody loved me since my mama, and she died when I was little. I knew the brochure had to be something religious, but her saying that about somebody loving me and her having the courage to give me the brochure when she knew it was against the law, that was the only thing made me not throw it away or cuss her to her face. I read it that night, and I'm glad the Bible verses were in it, 'cause I ain't seen no Bible for years. What got me was it wasn't fancy, wasn't hard to understand, didn't get all complicated. It just told me God loved me, Jesus died for me, and Jesus is coming again. All them scriptures sounded true to me about being a sinner, being separated from God, and Jesus being the way back to him. Before I knew it, that was the only thing I wanted. I didn't know how I'd live, what I'd eat, nothing. But I knew I wanted Jesus. Next time I saw Shaniqua, I just about attacked her, didn't I, honey? I told her
She had to tell me how to get Jesus in my life. She told me it was simple. All I had to do was pray and mean it. Tell God I was sorry for the mess I made of my life and take Jesus as my Savior. It ain't been easy, but know what? I'm ready for when Jesus comes.
The believers wanted to be together by 8 this morning, and they had settled on a parking lot of a former shopping center. Enoch had warned that a daylight assembly of that size would surely bring out the GC, and they would be looking for marks of loyalty.
"Let him be checking us when Jesus appears," someone said, and the rest applauded.
As Enoch quickly showered and dressed, he found himself less worried about interference. The destruction of New Babylon in the space of 1 hour had so thrown into chaos the international economy that it seemed nothing else mattered to anyone but believers. Suicides were at an all-time high, and he sensed an anti-Carpathian spirit among the formerly loyal. Social and community services, already devastated by the population loss of the last few years, were now virtually non-existent, and rumor had it that even local GC enforcement personnel would be hamstrung without fuel or money for more. Salaries had been frozen for 2 years as it was, and now it seemed clear to the populace that there would be zero pay for government employees until further notice. The private sector, what was left of it, was in disarray as well. Carpathia's tentacles had reached so far into every avenue of life and commerce that the virtual bankruptcy of the international government was certain to cripple everyone within days. Enoch had read of great depressions and bank failures throughout history, but no one had seen anything as far-reaching as this. Muggings, robberies, break-ins, all the unsavory acts that had been the purview of the underworld now became part and parcel of everyday life for all. It was every man for himself now, and any vestige of politeness or manners or even lawfulness would soon be history. Enoch prayed Jesus would return right on schedule. It was nearing 1600 hours, 4 o'clock in the afternoon in Jerusalem. Mac felt slimy in his GC Unity Army uniform and had to fight the temptation to shout his true identity and open fire without worrying about who was watching. He could take out a few dozen more Carpathian troops, but what was the use? They'd be gone soon enough as it was. The resistance, except behind the walls and the Temple Mount, had been virtually obliterated. Unity forces congratulated each other as they combed through rebel casualties, gathering the spoils. Mac pretended to do the same in a desperate last-ditch effort to find Buck, though he ignored the eyes of people who thought they were his compatriots. Nothing would give him greater satisfaction than seeing Buck standing tall on the Temple Mount when the end came. Mac was near the half-crumbled wall just west of Herod's Gate when a phone hit the ground next to him and he heard someone curse above him. The phone looked familiar, but as he reached for it, he heard, "Don't waste your time. Nothing left of it." Mac looked up to a young Unity troop bending over a fallen rebel. "Nice boots, though, and my size. He left one of them in the wall here." The soldier untied the other boot and was wrenching it off the body when it pulled free and slipped from his hands, dropping toward Mac. He snatched it from the air and recognized it as Buck's.
"Hey, toss that up here, will you?"
the soldier said, digging the other boot from a crevasse where Buck had apparently left it as he struggled free. Trembling, Mac tightened his fists around the boot.
"A little help, huh, pal?"
the soldier said, briefly turning back to the stuck boot. Mac took a step to get a good angle. Just as the young man freed the boot from the crack and turned toward him, Mac harkened back to his sporting days as a youth. He fired the matching boot so hard that the raider had no chance to react. The sole caught the bridge of his nose and sent him catapulting back over the wall. To be sure he wouldn't have to face him again, Mac hurried through the gate. He found the young man splayed on the ground, clearly dead. He ran back in and found enough holes and protrusions to hoist himself up to where Buck lay.
He wanted to do something, anything, but he could think of nothing. Whatever he did besides appearing to ransack the body would only give him away, and what would be served? Mac sucked in deep breaths as he surveyed Buck's injuries, gaping wounds that left Buck in a deep pool of black blood so sticky that it had barely begun to run down the wall when it coagulated. His whole right side had been torn open, and wounds also disfigured his hip and neck. A bullhorn called for assignees to the potentate, and Mac knew he might be identified as an imposter if he didn't report. As he reluctantly pulled away from Buck, he prayed that the same fate had not befallen Rayford. It just wouldn't be right if no one from the original Trib force had survived to see the glorious appearing. It was 4 o'clock. Chapter 3. Despite his substantial injuries, Rayford had managed to crawl several hundred yards to an outcropping of rock. With his free hand, though its heel had been scraped raw, he somehow had scooped away enough topsoil from behind the rocks to allow himself to stretch out away from the relentless sun and beyond anyone's view. He had exhausted every reserve of strength and had to trade the hope of being seen by his own people for fighting off dehydration and blood loss long enough to survive until the glorious appearing. He gingerly positioned his body in the shallow grave in such a way that if he lost consciousness, his gashed temple would remain pressed against his hand. Every time he thought he had staunched the blood flow long enough for it to stop pulsing, he was proven wrong when he released his palm for even an instant. It was a relief to be out of the sun, but the benefit of the slightly lower temperature, with the topsoil gone, did not last. Within half an hour, Rayford's mouth and tongue were dry, and he felt his lips swelling. He fought drowsiness, knowing that unconsciousness was his enemy. His wounds stabbed, and he worried about going into shock. Delirium soon followed, and Rayford daydreamed about people spotting the ATV and following the trail of blood, only to find his lifeless body being pecked at by vultures. At times, he discovered he had roused himself to consciousness by singing, praying, or just babbling. As he stiffened and his temperature rose, he began to feel the deep pang of each injury, and he prayed God would just take him. "I wanted to see it from this side of heaven, but what's the difference? Relief, please. Relief." He wasn't sure, but he didn't think he could bleed to death from any wound other than the one to his temple. When it seemed everything had ebbed from him but his last breath, Rayford considered releasing his hand and letting his life's blood slip away, too. But he could not. He quickly lost all sense of time and had to remind himself that his watch seemed to be functioning properly, despite his fast-fading ability to focus. Rayford was stunned to see how little time had passed since he went careening. The sun was still high in the sky, but he would have bet hours had passed. It had been a mere 50 minutes. When he awoke groaning, he realized he had actually dozed with enough presence of mind to keep the pulsing temple damned. His neck was stiff, and he had the feeling he would be unable to stand or even roll into a crawling position if his life depended on it. If someone didn't find him soon, his life would depend on moving yet again. But that simply wasn't in the cards. It seemed hours later, and Rayford was bereft of hope. He heard the advancing Unity Army and was surprised to see the sun still nearly directly overhead. It would remain that way until late afternoon, he knew, but he wouldn't have been surprised to open his eyes to dusk. No such luck. Far in the distance, he heard the high-pitched whine of a powerful dirt bike, the type Abdullah Smith rode. The Jordanian would buzz about Petra, careful in the crowds, then find his way out to the desolate slopes where he would really open it up. Rayford could only pray that what he heard was Smitty searching for him. He tried to sit up, but couldn't. If he had to guess, he'd have said Smitty was in the area where the ATV had finally landed, That was a long, long way from Rayford's meager shelter. He tried to stay conscious so he could call out if the dirt bike sound grew nearer, but he knew it would also have to be shut off if the rider were to hear him. Rayford realized his pain had spread past the spots that had taken the most direct abuse. His head throbbed all over. His eyes had become supersensitive to light, and he could barely open them to peek at his watch. His neck hurt, his shoulders were tight and achy, his back felt as if hot pokers were piercing his ribs. He was hungry, nauseated, and alternated between overheating and shivering. His leg muscles and even his toes cramped. In and out of consciousness now, when he finally heard the dirt bike slowly approaching, Rayford was certain he was imagining it. When the engine died, Rayford tried to move, to grunt, to do anything to let Smitty or whomever know he was there.
Big Dog One, this is Camel Jockey. And Techie, are you there? I've spotted Captain Steele, or at least I think I have. The trail stops here, and I do not expect to like what I see. Hold on.
Rayford's breathing was so shallow he was certain Abdullah would not be able to tell he was alive. He couldn't move a muscle, let alone turn his head, wave, or wiggle a foot. When he heard Smitty's steps in the sand, he fought to open an eye. Nothing was working. Was Smitty really there, or was this some sort of a near-death experience?
"Ah, I think he's gone," Abdullah said. "I mean, no, he's here, but I do not think he made it."
Rayford felt the index finger on his free hand bouncing, but clearly Smitty wasn't looking at it.
"Oh, Captain Steele," the Jordanian said as he gently rolled Rayford onto his back.
He sounded so grief-stricken that Rayford was moved. Rayford kept his palm locked against his temple, but rather than persuading Abdullah he was alive, it must have made him think rigor mortis was already setting in. And so Rayford did the only thing he could manage. He pulled his hand away an inch. By now the blood had clotted enough that it did not immediately squirt from the wound. And Abdullah apparently hadn't noticed the movement. Rayford felt the pressure building in his temple, and as Smitty straightened Rayford's legs, the wound broke loose.
"Well, hello," Abdullah said. "Dead men do not bleed. You are there, are you not?"
Rayford clamped his hand over the wound again and managed a, "Yeah, good to see you."
"Don't talk, Captain. I do not want to lose you before the big event."
Thought this was the big event. But Abdullah was back on the phone.
"Chang, he's alive. I need help here as quickly as you can send it. Yes, Leah would be perfect. Ask her to bring everything she can carry. I will launch a flare in 10 minutes.
Mac fell in with Unity Army troops in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem's old city and followed them to an obscure but lavishly guarded entrance underground. No one got even close without proper credentials, and Mac fought to maintain his composure as two sentinels held his photo ID next to his cheek and studied it. He could only hope none of Zeke's dye had worn off in the skirmishes. He and those with him were directed to a pressed dirt path at least 30 feet wide and lined on either side with narrow wood steps that led deep under the northern wall and past the Temple Mount. They continued directly beneath the only ground in Jerusalem still held by the resistance, and it was, of course, surrounded by the Unity Army. Were the rebels holding their own, or were they virtually imprisoned? Mac worried about Rayford and wished he'd had an opportunity to call Chang or Sebastian or Abdullah. Ri Wu was leading a platoon on the opposite side of Petra's perimeter. Maybe he'd seen Rayford. But now Mac had to turn off his phone. The passageway to Solomon's stables was so dimly lit that he and the others were immediately forced to raise their tinted visors. Still, the effect was like coming into a dark theater from the bright sun, and the soldiers slowed and felt their way along so as not to fall down the stairs. Mac was grateful the edge of his helmet rode low over his eyebrows, not exposing that he bore no mark of loyalty. Being a few steps out of the afternoon sun cooled his face and neck, and he was tempted to remove his gloves. He was nearly overcome by the reek of horse manure and urine, which grew worse as they neared the stables. As they reached the southeast corner of the Temple Mount, some 40 feet underground, they came within sight of Solomon's stables, a series of pillars and arches that had once supported the southeastern platform of the courtyard above. The halls, made up of a dozen avenues of pillars, were a little over 30 yards wide, 60 yards long, and nearly 30 feet high. At least 100 men, not in uniform, seemed to be tending more than 1,000 horses. The odor alone took Mac back to his childhood, and he wondered how he had ever grown used to it.
"Attention!" someone shouted. "Silence for your potentate!"
Everything and everyone stopped, and Mac wondered where Nikolai could be. Mac and several other uniforms had their backs pressed up against a wall, standing at attention. He recognized Carpathia's voice coming from inside a pillared room.
"Gentlemen and ladies, you will be pleased to know that several months of renovations here were accomplished in the space of fewer than 3 weeks. The sanitation facilities are second to none, at least for humans, and best of all, per my instructions, they empty into the legendary cradle of Jesus."
Leave it to Carpathia to sicken Mac with his first words. Mac had never heard of the cradle of Jesus, at least in the context of the Temple Mount. Many others apparently hadn't either, for Leon Fortunato was called upon to explain.
"Thank you, Excellency. The cradle of Jesus can be accessed down a winding staircase in the southeast corner. This leads to a chamber approximately 50 by 70 feet, where in the past there have been both a basilica named for St. Mary and a mosque. There is also, on the west wall, some ancient Byzantine art. Should you care to view the chamber, be forewarned of its current use, which we feel is more appropriate to something bearing its name. You will want to hold your nose. You'll be glad to get back to the odor of mere horses." Suhail Akbar was next, Carpathia's chief of security and intelligence.
"Having just arrived from Mount Megiddo," he began, "I am pleased to report that everything and everyone is in place for our soon unequivocal victory. Despite reports of discord due to the destruction of New Babylon..."
Suddenly a shout, more of a scream, but Mac clearly recognized Carpathia's voice. He cursed and cursed again.
"Tell me, Suhail," he raged. "Tell me you are not going to violate my specific order to never again mention the name of..."
"But, sir, I merely meant to..."
"You dare interrupt me? Do you see yourself above corporal punishment?"
"No, sir, I..." Something slammed the table.
"I should have you executed this instant. I should do it myself."
"Excellency, please. I was saying that despite what we have heard, the truth is..."
"The truth is that I will rebuild New Babylon right here in Jerusalem. She shall be restored to 1,000 times her former beauty and majesty. I have decreed there shall be no more mention of what has become of her."
"My humble apologies, potentate, I..."
"Silence! I have spoken. Back to your quarters, Chief Akbar. Your services will not be required again until further notice."
The commander in charge of Mac's unit quickly stepped forward and conferred with a colleague at the entrance to the meeting room. He backed away as a half dozen guards led out an ashen Suhail Akbar. The commander then silently pointed to 6 uniformed men at attention, including Mac, and directed them inside to replace those who had left.
Rayford's lucidity had returned somewhat after Abdullah slowly worked a liter of water into him. Leah arrived on a small ATV with two coolers full of supplies and tossed a clipboard to Abdullah.
"Would you do the honors, sir?"
"The honors?"
"Take notes."
"Of course." Rayford kept interrupting her. "What's the buzz at Petra? They think Jesus is late?"
"Hush!"
"Come on, Leah. I gotta know if we've all been off by a day."
"Nobody's off,"
she said distractedly, coolly inventorying his injuries.
"Chaim has everyone calmed down."
"How? What's he saying?"
"God's ways are not our ways. He's on his own clock, that kind of thing."
"Leah, you love this, don't you?"
"Sorry?"
"Having me at your mercy."
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Yes, you do. We..."
"Mr. Smith,"
she said,
"I'll be suturing the head wound. The chin, the arms, the right hand, and the knees can wait. The left shin bone may be broken, but I won't attempt to set it until we can be sure. I'm going to need to study the right ankle and probably suture that, too. And we're going to need some kind of conveyance to get him back up to the compound, probably within half an hour."
"You love this, Leah. I can tell."
"You're delirious."
"What kind of conveyance, Miss Rose?" Abdullah said.
"I need him prone."
Abdullah got back on the phone. "You could be just a little rougher with me than you might be with another patient, just to get back at me." Rayford was teasing and trying to smile, but Leah clearly wasn't biting.
"Back at you for what?"
"For how I used to talk to you."
"Well, maybe you owe me, too," she said.
"Maybe I do, but I'm in no position to exact revenge."
"And I have your flesh wounds in my hands. Now keep quiet and let me work."
It was all Mac could do not to burst out laughing when he saw Carpathia. Had the man been wearing a black hat, he would have looked like Zorro. A shirt with a frilly collar represented the only white in his ensemble. Everything else, from his knee-length boots to his leather pants, vest, and thigh-length cape-like coat, was black. Leon was in his most resplendent, gaudiest day-glow get-up, including a purple felt fez with multiple hangy-downs and a cranberry vestment with gold collar, appliqued with every religious symbol known to man, save the cross of Christ and the Star of David. A turquoise ring on his right middle finger was so large it covered the adjoining knuckles. If only God had scheduled the glorious appearing on Halloween. Carpathia stood at the head of an enormous polished wood table around which sat, if Mac could guess from their native garb, the sub-potentates from each of the 10 international regions, their entourages, and Carpathia's brain trust, sans Chief Akbar, of course. There had to be more than 50 gathered. Viv Ivins sat demurely in her customary sky-blue suit, with hair to match, 6 chairs from Nikolai on his far left side. She seemed even paler than Mac had remembered, and he thought he detected a trembling in her fingers as she busied herself taking notes. The others, despite their positions of high authority on Carpathia's cabinet and around the world, also seemed tentative in his presence. The outburst against Suhail Akbar had clearly shaken them all. Mac was near the entrance, one of the last few to have entered, and he realized that the 6 sentries he and his platoon mates had replaced had filled out a contingent of another 50 or so who lined the walls of the long room. Knowing what it had taken even to be allowed underground, he had to wonder against whom they were protecting Carpathia. Was he afraid of his own people? Chang had walked Naomi back into the tech center.
"What am I going to do?" he said. "I'll never sleep tonight, and I'm wasted."
"Surely you don't think we'll have to wait another day?"
"I don't know what to think.
Today is the day, love. There's no question. I hope you're right. I'm wired, but at some point I'm going to crash. Dr. Rosenzweig wants me to get him on international TV just before dark. You may have to prop me up. You'll rise to it. You always do.
The wall at his back, made of large blocks of stone, cooled Mac through his uniform jacket. He desperately wanted to peek at his watch. He knew it was well after 1600 hours now, and he believed Jesus could come any second. This was the last place he wanted to be when that happened, but being here was part of the price he paid to find Buck, and there was the prospect of seeing the look on Carpathia's face. Mac tried to appear focused on his menial task, providing showy security where none was needed, but when he ran through his mind what he really wanted to be doing, he found it difficult to concentrate. Besides being in broad daylight in the holy city when the Lord Christ appeared, second choice was opening fire on Carpathia from his perfect vantage point. There would be none of that, he knew. It fit no prophetic scenario, but how fulfilling it would be. Nothing would come of such foolhardiness, of course. The man had been murdered once, and was he now even a man? Doctors Ben-Judah and Rosenzweig said he was now indwelt by Satan himself, a spirit being using a human body, albeit a dead one. In addition, Max simply wanted to take a load off. The idea of sliding to his seat on the floor, of stretching out with his hands behind his head, well, that was something that would come once Jesus had taken his rightful place. Mac's friends and comrades often talked about what kind of a world they would live in soon, but he kept to himself the idea that what he most longed for was simply rest. He was certain he was not alone in this. Others had hinted at it. They had all been so busy, so stressed, so sleep-deprived, and all that had only worsened as the days grew nearer to the glorious appearing. The idea of living in a world of peace and safety so appealed to Mac that he could barely imagine it. To be able to sleep without half an eye or ear figuratively open to danger, well, talk about heaven on earth. And to be reunited with friends and loved ones, it was nearly too much to get his mind around. Best of all, of course, to see Jesus personally. Would he get to touch him, to speak with him? Mac felt so new as a believer, so limited in his knowledge of the things of God. He felt as if he had been attending seminary under the Tribulation Force's spiritual leaders ever since Rayford had led him to faith. But there was so much he didn't know. All he knew was that Jesus loved him, had died for his sins, and was the reason he didn't have to fear death and hell. Chang had been called before Dr. Rosenzweig and the elders. "Of course I can do it," he said. "But the GC has been improving on wresting back control of the airwaves. The shorter the broadcast, the more likely I can keep it on without interruption."
"I plan to be brief," Chaim said. "And if...
You're wondering what happens, hoping as I am, if Messiah returns first?"
"Or in the middle of it," Chang said.
"Well, I should think that event would take precedence, wouldn't you?"
Chang smiled as the elders laughed.
"Rabbi Rosenzweig is attempting," Eliezer Tiberius said, "to persuade the rest of the Jewish population, those who have refused the mark of the beast and yet who have not acknowledged Jesus as the Messiah, to do just that. He, and we agree, estimates that this may constitute a third of the remaining Jewish population. You understand that these are God's chosen people, his children from the beginning of time. All of Scripture is his love letter to them, his plan for them."
"Understand it," Chang said.
I can't say that I do, but I believe it. Chaim stood.
We must not delay. As I have said so many times, we know the day, today, but we do not know the hour. If we thought we did, we were wrong, were we not, Eliezer?
The big man smiled. I acknowledge it. But is it not also true that we know the sequence of events, so we have some idea what follows by what comes next?
That is what I will be talking about on the broadcast, my friends.
Before the anesthetic took effect in his temple, Rayford fought to keep from recoiling from the thrust of the needle. He was amazed that a new twinge of pain could supersede all the others, and he was also struck by Leah's gentleness as she cradled his head and assured him the sting would soon fade.
"You're being much better to me than I deserve," he said, knowing he sounded groggy and hoping she understood.
"Will you stop with that now, Captain? I have work to do, and while I know you're trying to keep things light, I don't need to be worrying if you're serious."
He reached for her hand.
"Take a minute, Leah. I am serious.
When you first came to us, you know that we sniped at each other. I wasn't used to your types of questions and probably was threatened by them. I never made that right, but as far as I could tell, you never made me pay."
She pressed her lips together.
"And I'm not about to now. Listen, Ray, you're hurt more badly than you know. My job is to stabilize you, keep you from going into shock. The fact that you haven't already is a miracle, but you apparently need to hear this, so let me tell you. My failure was that I never cleared the air between us either. Fact is, you eventually won me over. Everybody could see how much you cared for all of us, how tireless you were, how you put everybody else ahead of your own needs."
Rayford was embarrassed. He hadn't meant to elicit this, nice as it was. He squeezed her hand.
"Okay, okay," he said. "We're friends again."
"Think of the people who will be in heaven because of you," she said.
"All right, enough," he said. "I was just trying to thank you for not rubbing it in."
"Now will you hush?"
"I will, ma'am."
Mac noticed Viv Ivins look up with a start, but then recover quickly. Carpathia had asked,
"Photographers in place and ready, Ms. Ivins?"
"Yes, Excellency."
"I shall be on horseback," he said. "All Global Community Unity Army personnel in this room, plus their superiors, shall also ride. Your mounts are being saddled as we speak."
Mac panicked. How long had it been since he had ridden? Was it like riding a bicycle? Would it all come back to him? He had never been atop a steed the size of the thoroughbreds in the stables. Any horse responded to a sure, confident hand. The beast had to know the rider was in charge. He might have to fake that bravado.
"Are you looking directly at me, soldier?" Carpathia demanded.
"No, sir,"
the young Brit next to Mac said, eyes darting everywhere but at Nikolai.
"You most certainly were. You would have done better to admit it and beg forgiveness."
"Affirmative, sir. I was, and I regret it, and offer my sincerest abject apologies."
"That is the second time you have referred to me as sir. Have you not been instructed neither to look directly at me nor to refer to me in any manner except as—"
"Yes, Excellency. My apologies, Supreme Pot—"
"And now you deign to interrupt me?"
The Brit's voice was quavery, and Mac believed his legs were about to fail him.
"Sorry,"
the young man whispered.
"I cannot hear you, soldier."
"I'm sorry, Excellency. Forgive me."
"Who is your superior officer?"
"Commander Tenzin, sir. Excellency—"
Carpathia cursed the man.
"Commander Tenzin!"
The Indian commander rushed in, bowing.
At your service, Excellency.
Commander, have you taught your men who I am?
I have, Lord Potentate.
All of them?
Yes, my king.
And the privilege of serving God on earth?
Absolutely, Divine One.
Even this man? Your name, son?
Ipswich, Excellency, he said, tears flowing now.
Mac wanted to shoot Carpathia dead and feared he just might if the Potentate approached. Commander Tenzin, what is that in your hand?
A rattan rod, Excellency. I so look forward to the privilege of riding with you today.
The rod was an inch thick and appeared to Mac about 4 feet long. If I told you that Mr. Ipswich has flouted your training, could you think of an appropriate use for your rattan rod, Commander Tenzin?
I could, Your Grace.
Ipswich was whimpering. And would you do me the honor of employing it in my presence, for my entertainment and for the education of all? Without another word, Tenzin stepped forward and drew back the rod. Before Ipswich could even recoil, his commander lashed his face with such speed and force that the stick caught him just to the left of his nose, splitting both lips, cracking some teeth, and slicing his left eyelid. Ipswich screamed and grabbed his face with both hands, bending at the waist. Tenzin brought the rod down on the back of his neck, just above the hairline, opening a gash that spattered blood on Mac's face and chest. It was all he could do to keep from attacking the Indian. As Ipswich pitched forward, Tenzin cracked him twice across the backside in quick succession, the second blow tearing his uniform pants. That drove him to the floor, and as he tried to scramble away, his commander followed, raining blows on his back. Carpathia howled in delight.
When he can crawl no more, Commander Tenzin, spare the rod and put him out of his misery.
Another soldier was quickly enlisted to replace Ipswich in line. He entered, pale and shaky, and quickly came to rigid attention.
Oh, Carpathia moaned, clasping his hands and gazing upward. What a way to start the day. Leon.
Yes, Holy One.
Ask Commander Tenzin to pay a visit to Chief Akbar.
Certainly, Lord.
But instruct him to punish him only to the point of near death.
Chapter 4 Enoch Dumas led more than 100 the place followers around the back of the abandoned Illinois shopping center. Just before 8 in the morning, he had begun to teach, trying to inform his people and a few interested others what should precede the glorious appearing. None of the heavenly preliminaries had begun, and he sensed the disappointment, doubt, and fear on the part of his little band of believers. But mostly, he had found himself looking over his shoulder at the main road. Though there were few vehicles of any type about, given the fuel shortage and the crippled economy, he knew the local GC had not shut down completely. They would have to investigate a meeting of this size, and the discovery of that many people, not one bearing the mark of loyalty to Carpathia, would result in a bloodbath. There was no longer any earthly excuse not to bear the mark, and punishment was execution on the spot by any means. Even a civilian had the right to put to death an insurgent. All that was required for exoneration from the crime of homicide was either to drag the victim to a local GC headquarters and prove he or she bore no visible mark, or to flag down a patrolling morale monitor or GC peacekeeper and get him to confirm the same. In fact, there was a healthy bounty on such offenders, and citizens loyal to the potentate competed for cash prizes. Many made their living as vigilantes, and some were famous for their impressive number of kills. Perhaps that was why Enoch found his usually bold congregation willing to follow him from the public light of day to the relative seclusion of the other side of the empty mall.
If we knew Jesus would get here before the GC, we could stay where we are. But I, for one, do not want to have survived 7 years, only to die just before he comes back. The group crowded into an inner court where it was obvious they all felt safer, but they had questions. When's it gonna happen? What did we miss in the prophecies? Did you only think the weeks meant years or what? Could we be off by a long ways? I don't think so, Enoch said. But I don't know. I was never a scholar or a theologian. I'm sort of a blue-collar student of all this, just like you all are. But I have been reading and studying for years. While there's a lot of disagreement and debate, so far everything, every element of the prophecies, has been fulfilled literally, the way it was spelled out. I have to believe today is the day.
Hold on, a woman shouted from the back.
She was peering into a tiny TV.
Looked like somebody done took over the GC's airwaves again.
People crowded around.
That Micah guy, she said, running things at Petra is gonna speak about what comes next.
Others pulled mini TVs from their pockets and bags.
Should we listen, Brother Enoch? Will you be offended?
Hardly, Enoch said, digging out his own TV. What could be better than this? Dr. Rosenzweig is a scholar's scholar. Let's have church. The assembled put their tiny screens together on a concrete bench and turned them up so the combined volume reached everyone. Max saw the narrowing of Carpathia's eyes and feared someone else was about to catch his rage. His attention had been drawn to the entrance of the room.
Yes, what is it? Carpathia said.
An underling said,
Begging the potentate's pardon, but, Excellency, you asked to be informed.
What? What?
The zealots at Petra, the Judahites.
I know who is at Petra. What now?
They have pirated their way onto GC television again.
Carpathia flushed and leaned over the table, resting on his palms. His jaw muscles tightened.
Turn it on, he said through clenched teeth.
Leon nearly toppled, trying to pull out a chair. He sat heavily and made a show of reaching far up under his robe and producing a remote control laser, which he aimed at the wall behind Nikolai. A screen descended and the picture appeared. Chaim Rosenzweig, seated on a simple set deep in the confines of Petra. His open Bible was before him, and he bore a pastoral smile. A timer showed that he would begin in less than a minute. Carpathia looked over his shoulder at the screen, then turned back and slammed both fists on the table.
First, he shouted. Confirm that Ipswich is dead. Then tell Tenzin I have changed my mind about Akbar. I want him dead, too. Finally, get hold of security at Al-Hilla. Inform them of the demise of their chief and tell them the following order comes directly from me. Whatever it takes, I want security to take over our broadcast center. I want the management personnel shot to death through both eyes, one administrator at a time, from the top down through the chain of command, one every 60 seconds until someone has wrested back control of the airwaves. Understood?
No one moved or spoke.
Understood?
Yes, Excellency.
Leon said, reaching for his phone.
I'm on it,
Viv Ivan said, phone already to her ear. Carpathia whirled and faced the screen.
Does no one understand? He railed. Does no one recognize this man? This is the one who assassinated me. And while I raised myself from the dead and reign as your living lord, he remains a thorn in my side. Well, no longer, not after today. A third of our entire army will overrun Petra tonight, and he shall be my personal target.
With hydration and an IV started by Leah, Rayford at last began to feel he might make it. He still felt as if he had been run over by a tank, and there would be no walking or helping himself get off this godforsaken slope. But his mental faculties were returning, and he came to believe that Leah and Abdullah would somehow get him back to the compound.
"Two things, Miss Rose," Abdullah said.
"Shoot."
"According to Miss Pale Moon, we have a problem with the conveyance."
"What problem? There's a stretcher in the co-op, and a gurney, too."
"She checked with Mrs. Wu, and they both believe these will be impossible to transport to this location." Leah sat back, and Rayford saw her scan the hills above her, leading to Petra.
"She may have a point. What's number two?"
"She says Micah is on GC television and that we might want to tune it in."
"Do you have a TV, Mr. Smith?"
"Of course."
"Well, the captain is as stable as I can make him, and we may be here a while. Let's have a look."
Abdullah pulled a small TV from a leather bag attached to his bike.
"You want to see this, Captain?"
Leah said. Chang was glued to his monitor, but he asked Naomi to gather around him the rest of the techies on duty.
"Check this out, people," he said. "Look at the counter in the upper left of the screen."
Whistles and backslaps and exultations followed the speeding numbers, racing upward by the tens of thousands a second, but having already surged far past the largest television audience in history. Nothing Carpathia ever broadcast had come close. In fact, the previous three records had all been held by Zion Ben Judah.
"Dearly beloved," Chaim had begun, "I speak to you tonight, probably for the last time, before the glorious appearing of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ the Messiah. He could very well come during this message, and nothing would give me greater pleasure. When he comes, there will be no more need for us to fight Antichrist and his false prophet. The work will have been done for us by the King of Kings. But as he did not return 7 years to the minute from the signing of the covenant between Antichrist and Israel, many are troubled and confused. I wish to speak to that here, but mostly I need to be brief, for as you know, we commandeer these airwaves against the wishes of our archenemy, and you must believe that he is doing everything in his power right this very instant to bump us. More important than discussing the time of Messiah's return, however, which I can summarize in a sentence, I believe he will be here before midnight Israel time, is the spiritual state of my fellow Jews around the globe. If you have never listened before, lend me an ear this day. This is your last chance, your final warning, my ultimate plea with you to recognize and accept Jesus as the Messiah you have for so long sought. You have heard many times the proclamations of my dear friend and colleague, Dr. Zion Ben Judah, who outlined the numerous prophecies that soon came to pass. If these never persuaded you, hear me now and know that it is likely this very day that you will see the signs in the sky heralding the glorious appearing of Jesus. The Bible says in Matthew 24, verses 29 and 30, that immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. This is the last day of the tribulation that was prophesied thousands of years ago. Today is the 7th anniversary of the unholy and quickly broken covenant between Antichrist and Israel. What's next? The sun, wherever it is in the sky where you are, will cease to shine. If the moon is out where you are, it will go dark as well, because it is merely a reflection of the sun. Do not fear. Do not be afraid. Do not panic. Take comfort in the truth of the Word of God and put your faith in Christ, the Messiah. What does it mean that the powers of the heavens will be shaken? I do not know. But, beloved, I cannot wait to find out. The Bible says God will show wonders in heaven above and signs in the earth beneath. Blood and fire and vapor of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. I expect a show like I have never witnessed, but I will be safe, as he has promised. Will you be safe? Are you ready? Are you prepared? Do not put it off.